From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Happy, Happy Swim Day, we talk with swimming instructor Jim Spears about his techniques for teaching toddlers how to swim. Often it begins with just getting them into the water, which he does with a song. Spears students are as young as 6 months. Also, we meet writer, producer, actor Ken Finkelman of The Newsroom. It's the CBC comedy show that spoofs TV news. Finkelman plays the insecure news director more concerned about ratings and his company parking space than ethics. First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. No talks are scheduled today between representatives of United Parcel Service and its striking workers. But Labor Secretary Alexis Herman is going to meet separately with each side to ask them again to return to the bargaining table. NPR's Monica Brady reports.
Despite Labor Secretary Herman's efforts, both sides are preparing for a long strike. Tuesday, the Teamsters got a pledge of financial support from the AFL-CIO to cover striking benefits for a prolonged walkout. And UPS says it may have to cut costs by laying off workers. UPS says talks broke down because the union refuses to let the company pull out of the union-run multi-employer pension fund. UPS's Leah Supata says if the company could create its own fund, workers would get higher benefits.
We feel that we can provide dramatic improvements to the pension benefits for our people when we utilize UPS dollars for UPS people.
The union is opposed to this. As a profitable company, UPS helps subsidize the pensions of other Teamsters in the fund. I'm Monica Brady in Washington.
U.S. Peace Envoy Dennis Ross says his latest shuttle mission to the Middle East has moved things a lot in relations between the Israelis and Palestinians. His work has helped to create new talks aimed at security cooperation between both sides. CIA officials are participating in the three-way meetings that got started this week. The United Nations mediator running the deadlocked talks on Cyprus has submitted new proposals to Greek and Turkish Cypriot leaders. The envoy has asked them to present their views on the papers today. NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Halfway through the five-day conference in a hotel near Montreux, Switzerland, there's still little progress to report. Today, the Greek Cypriot and the Turkish Cypriot leaders are supposed to present their opinions on the two new working papers. The Turkish Cypriot leader has said he will not sign a joint declaration at the end of these talks on Friday. The talks are being moderated by the United Nations. Diplomats say there is little hope of a breakthrough on such key questions as the division of political power. The Turks make up about 18% of the island. They hold about 40% of the land, and they insist on political equality. And the Turkish Cypriots, stung by Turkey's recent denial of entry into the European Union, are threatening to attempt to scuttle Cyprus's recent invitation to join the EU. In Glion, Switzerland, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
A new study indicates the use of hard drugs by children is on the rise. The poll, sponsored by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, finds nearly a quarter of the survey 12-year-olds know a friend or a classmate who has used cocaine, heroin, or another strong drug. The figures more than doubled between 1996 and 97. Center Chairman Joseph Califano says this problem must be addressed at the local level. On Wall Street, the Dow was off 19 points at 79.41. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower in volatile trading. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market rallied at the opening as the Dow added 80 points in the first 15 minutes. A half hour later, though, the average was down by nearly 80 points. The day began with positive news on wholesale inflation. The producer price index unexpectedly fell in July. This is the seventh consecutive monthly drop in the PPI, which is a record. The news on producer prices supports the notion of stable interest rates, and as a result, rate-sensitive stocks are higher. But semiconductor shares have weakened after Merrill Lynch lowered earnings expectations for Micron Technology. And drug stocks are down for a third straight day on concern about slowing sales growth. I'm Doug Krisner.
Steelworkers in three states have overwhelmingly voted to adopt a new contract. The decision ends a 10-month strike against Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel Corporation. The walkout affected workers in West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Some workers will be back on the job today, but officials at Wheeling Pitt warn that recalled workers will need to depend on orders for steel for their jobs. The strike started October 1st last year when contracts expired without a resolution of key issues. Sunbeam Corporation says it's reached a deal with the American Medical Association to market health-related products with the doctor's group's name on it. An AMA official says the health organization will entertain other partnerships with other firms if the Sunbeam deal works. The AMA says it plans to use the money earned from the agreement with Sunbeam to finance public health care initiatives. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. What's summer without swimming? Forget the beach. If you can't swim, it's just a blindingly hot, scratchy, windy waste of time where you get skin cancer. And kiss kayaking, canoeing, sailing, rowing, water polo, and all the rest goodbye. If you have little kids, better stay far away from them in the summer, or they might sniff out your insecurity around the water and never go in either. All the evidence points to one immutable fact. Learning to swim is a good thing, and the younger you learn, the easier it goes. Jim Spears has led thousands of children and adults into the water and onto swimming mastery. He teaches swimming at Aerobics West Health Club in New York City. We thought we'd ask him for some swimming tips. The big question for parents is, at what age should they enroll their child in a swimming class? This is actually a real point of contention in the swimming world. The American Red Cross recommends that children not take lessons until they're 5 years old, but Jim Spears works with toddlers just 6 months old.
There's two sides, or I believe Red Cross has two sides to go for with that. First off, children are not going to swim a beautiful freestyle or crawl style before they're 5 years of age. But they can locomote onto their back, float, get air, and do the beginning skills that it takes to be a strong swimmer. That's what my program is technically about, is getting them to where they can roll onto their back, float, breathe, and basically hopefully take care of themselves in the water. My program is geared a lot towards parents that have beach houses or swimming pools or whatnot, where there's no choice but to at least try to get your child to swim, because there is water there and a kid's going to wander into the water. They're curious. That's their nature.
I was on vacation recently at a lake with my family, and I wasn't really sure how to tell my three-year-old about being safe around the water without making him even more fearful of the water than he already is. What's your advice to parents about how to keep kids safe but excited about swimming at that young age?
Well, at that young age, you know, three, I would take them in. I would definitely let them experience the water. I would get them into the pool or the lake or whatnot. Let them practice blowing bubbles. Teach them that when your face goes in the water, if you don't blow bubbles, you do end up drinking the water. Let them understand, like, the whole concept of this can be a dangerous thing. Of course, we don't use what I call the D word, the big drown word. Don't go in the water, you'll drown. We try to avoid that at all cost, because that really programs the child to think the water's a bad thing. So you just get them in the water and let them, you know, acclimate themselves to it and have a good time with it. But, you know, always tell them there needs to be an adult with you. There needs to be set up guidelines that make sense for the body of water you're around.
What do you think of swimming aids, like floaties and those water wings that you see everywhere? Are they worthwhile?
I think that they give a child a false sense of security. I have had a lot of children that have thought they've had their floaties on and gone into the pool and swam and then basically sank because they thought they could swim and they didn't have the floaties on. So I think, like, again, they give a false sense of security, but I don't necessarily say don't use them. Like, if I have a parent that's going to a pool and I know the parent will need a break, okay, use the floaties half the time. Take them off half the time so the child realizes that there's something keeping them afloat and there's a skill they have to do to swim as well.
What's the first thing you do in a class full of first-time kid swimmers?
Sing songs.
You start the class with a song.
Yes, we have a happy, happy song to start the class. We have a song for kicking, a song for blowing bubbles. We have songs for pulling your arms. We have songs for floating on your back, basically. So for the kids under the age of four, the whole program is through music. And when they hear a certain song, you start getting a certain skill.
What's the first skill that you teach a child?
The first skill that we teach a child would be kicking and blowing bubbles. They kind of come at the same time because they're in the same class. And we also teach floating on the back. Those are like the three main primary things we try to get them to do. But certain children will like floating on their back. Certain children will like putting their face in the water. And typically they don't like the other if they like one of them.
Now, where does treading water come in all of this? I always thought that was a really useful skill for someone who doesn't know how to swim.
Treading water is a useful skill, but if you think about it, treading water can also be a big struggle, especially if you're panicked. And so our primary goal is to get the child to roll over on their back and float and relax, because the key is to relax for, you know, a longer survival-type skill. That's why we tend to push the kids to roll on their back and float versus treading water first. And treading water is hard. Yeah, you've probably done it yourself. It's not an easy thing to do as far as comparing it to floating.
It used to be parents or people trying to teach kids how to swim would just throw them in the water. The tough love approach.
Yes, I've heard that rumor.
You don't do that.
No, we don't. Everything in our program is very... We believe in like creating the whole child. Everything is about the person who I developed this program with in Houston, Texas. Her name is Leslie Crawford, and she had her BS in psychology. I had the swimming skills under my belt, and together we got together, and I was very focused on how the mechanics worked. She was very focused on how the mind part of it worked. That's where a lot of the songs came into effect. That's where... everything that we do, like when a child finishes a skill, it's even if the child is... you know, coughing and sputtering on the water, it's always greeted with a good job or fantastic or way to go, dude, or whatever, to where they're feeling positive about the experience, even if it's something that's a little frightening.
Most kids don't want to put their heads underwater. How do you coax them into that?
We do it. We basically take the child, If the child's over the age of 4 or 5, then yes, you definitely have to coax them, and you do it through different games, such as putting things on the bottom of the pool and telling them to look at them, or just trying to get them to blow bubbles and then say, okay, I'm not going to blow bubbles with your mouth and nose in the water, and then let's add the eyes to that. And just a gradual process to get their face in the water. With younger kids who aren't necessarily verbalizing so much at the time, then we have a system where you count 1, 2, 3, you say bubbles, you blow across their face, which causes them to inhale. It's the same principle of like if you opened a door and a cold blast of wind has hit you in the face, you breathe in as an adult. It's the same thing for a child. They'll automatically breathe in, and then you submerge them. And when the lungs are full, they can take on no more water or air. So then the next thing they have to do is blow out.
Have you ever had anything go wrong, I guess dangerously wrong, during a lesson?
No. The most dangerous thing I would think that really has ever gone what you would call wrong in a lesson is a parent, in my opinion, is a parent stopping a lesson when a child's really fearful. Because the only danger involved with that is the child thinking there was a reason to be afraid, if that makes sense. If a child is afraid and the parents are wanting to stop and like come back at it again, I request that they stay in the pool for like another 2 or 3 lessons. And we'll just have fun in the water. We won't do any kind of work. We won't do any kind of hard skills. So the child leaves on a positive note. And that way, the most damaging thing I think that's ever happened in my class is a parent pulling a child out, and the child was upset with the water, and then it took forever to get the child back in.
It sounds as if, at least for the younger kids, that you have to work as much with parents as you do with kids. Which are harder?
Parents are much harder than the children. Children are great. They've been, you know, from birth, they've been taught that they've got to do this. An adult's talking to them, they have to do what they're told. Once you become an adult, then you have opinions and questions, and this is your child, and needs to be raised, my child, and needs to be raised this way. And that's when it starts to become a little more difficult because you're spending a lot of time explaining to parents, no, this is really the reason why this should work this way, and so on and so forth.
So you have a parent second-guessing you while you're trying to teach the child to swim.
Oh, a lot of the time. Oh, yeah. Or that just doesn't necessarily jive with their parenting philosophy. And then you got to, like, talk through it to see what they want. You got to explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. You've got parents that will get into the class and say, oh, well, this is their first time, and we really shouldn't put their face underwater. Well, yeah, you should, because that's how you teach kids how to swim. They got to get their face in. Or you'll get a note from the mom on the fifth lesson that, I told them they don't have to put their face in the water or float or swim to you off the table. Well, okay, now you've tied my hands. What do I do?
Do you ever say, you over there, you have to go sit in the corner so I can
teach
your kids?
Oh, I kick parents out all the time. You're out of here. Bye. I'm always sending parents out of the room because sometimes parents just flat out get in the way of the learning process.
I'm speaking with Jim Spears. He's a swimming instructor who works in New York City. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with swimming instructor Jim Spears. You teach adults too, right?
Yes, yes.
My husband can't swim, and I'm not sure he's ever really figured out how that happened. He loves water sports and boating. What factors have you found that usually cause adults to be non-swimmers?
I mean, there's a multitude of reasons. It can be a traumatic experience as a child, such as kids holding kids underwater. It can be a problem at the beach, like where a wave knocked them over. It can be lack of exposure to the water. As a child, you know, the parents' interests were in different areas. It could be that they didn't get the right teacher, you know, and so that totally turned them off. Or it could be down to the fact that the water at camp was really cold and they weren't going in. It's any number of reasons why that they would not swim. The problem, though, with an adult and getting them to swim at that point becomes these many, many years and phobias that they've developed, oh, I can't swim, that you then got to have to get through.
Now, when adults come to you and say, I can't swim, do they have all sorts of myths or justifications? I'm thinking I've heard people say they're not capable of swimming because their bodies don't float like other members of the human race.
Right, or heavy bones. Yeah, we get all of those. And to be honest, a lot of the time, it's not that their bodies don't float. And granted, there are people that don't float. I am not a floater. I float on the bottom of the pool.
Is it a matter of body fat percentage?
Not percentage. It's a matter of where the body fat is. Basically, women tend to float better than men because the body fat's higher for carrying babies. Men's body fat's a little bit lower. Men's body fat's a little bit higher, even higher than where the women's body fat is. So men's legs tend to drag them down. If you ever watched a man try to float, his legs go first and his body follows all the way down to the bottom of the pool, which is my case. But there are very, very thin people that can float. It just depends on where the balance is in your body. And you can achieve a better balance by working with your arm placement, like when you're floating on your back, raising your hands underwater above your head makes your body longer, and it changes where the fulcrum is of your body. And it will make some people actually float. It's just playing with your body and figuring out what makes your body float.
How then do you get an adult into the water when they come to you with these phobias? It seems as if to teach adults, you'd have to be half a therapist, half a swim coach.
Well, the cool thing about adults is they've paid you money, and it's not like mom and dad paying you money. So they're like, okay, I've made this investment. I'm going to get in. And so you get them into the water, and then you just totally, you know, you explain away a lot of the problems that they're having in the water, you know, like putting their face in. Once they become adults, there's all kinds of different ways to exhale underwater. You can do it through your nose. You can do it through your mouth. You can do it long and slow. You can do it very fast, which is called explosive breathing. And so it's just working away until you find out what works for them.
And have you had failures with adults?
I have not. Yeah, I mean, there's been adults that you have really had. You know, I had one lady who cried every time that she was wanting to get into the pool. And don't make me get in, kind of thing. But at least she tried. She finished out what she started to do, which was at least get into the water. But I don't necessarily consider that a success because she didn't leave swimming. But she at least was less fearful about even getting into a pool.
What was that all about?
That was about she was washed up on a beach and resuscitated as a child. So there was a big fear there.
Oh, I can understand
about
that.
Being underwater.
My guest is Jim Spears. He's a swimming instructor in New York City, and we're talking about swimming, learning to swim, and pool safety. Most pool accidents seem to happen when parents are right there watching their kids. Do you think it happens because the kids do have this false sense of security, or even older children have a false sense of security because they've been taking swimming lessons and they think they can just do it?
Partially. That's part of the reason. The other part of the reason is just children are very curious, and so therefore they want to go experience the water on their own. You know, the older they get, the less they want mom and dad to be involved, the more they want to do things on their own, and the more trouble they get into with all aspects of life.
How fast can a child drown?
Once they start taking on water, it can happen anywhere between, like, and it depends on what you're calling drowning. Drowning is an experience where someone has to be rescued. Drowning does not necessarily mean dead. Because if a lifeguard has to go into the water, that is a drowning victim. They have to go get the person. So it depends on what you're looking for. And it's also very age appropriate. You know, it's anywhere from a minute to like 3 minutes as far as where brain damage starts to happen. As far as lack of oxygen to the brain and whatnot. It also depends on how long the child is struggling to stay above water. There's a lot of factors, but there was an experience I had in Houston, Texas, where a mom had two children, a three-year-old and a five-year-old, and she went into the house to get chalk. They're making like hopscotch boxes or something like that. And she came back out to find the five-year-old diving for the three-year-old who was on the bottom. And that's when she decided to enroll the kids in swimming lessons. The ambulance had to come. The child was resuscitated. He was taken to the hospital. The three-year-old, who was the one who had actually drowned and been brought back, resuscitated, had no problem with swimming. The five-year-old was petrified because he had the full memory of everything that had happened. And the three-year-old, to this day, still believes the ambulance came for the five-year-old, which made it easier to teach the three-year-old. But the five-year-old's phobias got a lot worse.
What was the end of that story?
They both swam beautifully.
If you do go to the aid of a drowning person, what's the first thing you should do?
No one that's not trained should go after a drowning person. You should take something with you, a pole, a towel, something to reach out to them so you can pull them back into shore. You should not make contact with them as long as they are conscious and active. Preferably you would, before ever leaving shore, have someone call for help and then go in and get them and bring them back out. But the Red Cross rules are reach, which means from deck, row, which means you're still in something, like a boat, throw, and then go. That's how they teach lifeguards. It's like their little mantra that they say, reach, throw, row, go.
What advice do you have for pool owners beyond just, you know, fence that pool in and fence it well? How can they prepare for emergencies?
They should have objects around the pool for such as poles, such as rescue tubes or ring buoys on ropes that they can throw out to people. They should, as I said before, you know, have CPR, have first aid. If they're good swimmers and they feel up to it, take a lifeguarding course. A fence is just a bigger obstacle. It's not going to necessarily keep someone out. It may keep them out, but it's more of a challenge to get over a fence. So it doesn't always keep a child out. And all the fences that I've seen in the Hamptons when I've been out there teaching this year, most of the children already know how to work the gate at age 3 and 5, and they can already get in.
How did you learn to swim?
My folks belonged to a residential pool in the neighborhood, and they had a really great swimming instructor there by the name of Lucky. He was a really great guy. And so at age 3, they stuck me in the pool. I had to start learning to swim. I took lots of private lessons, lots of group, and started swimming on a swim team when I was 5 years old.
So you had absolutely no dangerous or frightening swim experiences under your belt?
They were more dangerous for my mother, meaning she would come in and would have left me with the lifeguards, and at age 6 came back and saw me diving off the high board. So it was more like her like going, "There goes my kid," kind of thing.
But you were fine.
I was fine. She wasn't, but I was.
Jim Spears, thanks a lot for talking today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Swimming instructor Jim Spears. He teaches in New York City. I'm Barbara Bulgave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. London Times reporter Ben McIntyre was in Los Angeles covering the second Rodney King trial when he decided to take a break from present-day crime stories by delving into the archives of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. The result of McIntyre's investigations is a book called The Napoleon of Crime, the first biography of Adam Worth, the most famous criminal of the Victorian age. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Outlaws of yore always seem so quaint when compared to the Andrew Cunanans of our own day. But even allowing for the nostalgia that romanticizes psychopaths like Billy the Kid into folk heroes, Adam Worth comes across as a particularly gallant master felon. Worth was the real-life model for Sherlock Holmes's nemesis, Professor Moriarty, the brains behind decades of bank heists, forgeries, and diamond thefts across Europe and America. Worth was also a man of principle. He forbade the use of violence in his operations and abstained from alcohol to keep his wits about him. The discipline paid off, except for one gruesome 5-year stretch in a Belgian prison late in his career. Worth eluded capture by the police and the Pinkertons. Until now, Worth has also eluded capture by biographers, even though his life story is as sensational and strange as anything cooked up by his Victorian literary contemporaries. Indeed, in his just-published biography of Worth, entitled The Napoleon of Crime, Ben McIntyre claims Worth represents that most feared of Victorian boogeymen, the double man, the respectable and civilized Dr. Jekyll by day, whose Mr. Hyde villainy emerged only under cover of night. As a biographer, McIntyre indulges an inclination for rip-roaring hyperbole, but if ever a subject seemed to warrant it, Adam Worth does. Worth's double life began in his teens. The son of German-Jewish immigrants, Worth ran away from home and at the start of the Civil War enlisted in a New York regiment that was decimated at the Battle of Bull Run. According to official documents, Adam Worth died during that battle. McIntyre theorizes that Worth simply switched his identity papers with those of a corpse and deserted. Over the next few years, Worth ingratiated himself into New York's underworld, where he learned to be a master dipper, or pickpocket. After being arrested and sent to Sing Sing, from which he almost immediately escaped, Worth vowed not to risk his neck anymore on penny ante crime. He graduated to safe-cracking and soon relieved the vault of the Boylston Bank in Boston of close to $1 million. Afterwards, Worth hightailed it to England, where he changed his name to Henry Judson Raymond, cultivated the manners of a blue blood, and covertly presided over a hive of criminal activity. Even Worth's English wife didn't know his real identity. When Wirth was imprisoned in Belgium and his alias was revealed, the poor woman cracked up and spent the rest of her life in a lunatic asylum. But the most bizarre aspect of Wirth's story is his passionate attachment to the sexually suggestive portrait of the Duchess of Devonshire, painted by Thomas Gainsborough. The portrait had just been auctioned and was the talk of London when Wirth broke into the gallery where it was displayed and stole it, or as he later put it, eloped with the Duchess. For 25 years afterwards, Wirth kept the Duchess's portrait nearby, sometimes even hidden beneath the mattress of his four-poster bed. McIntyre theorizes that Wirth fixated on the portrait because it represented his aspirations to aristocratic respectability and his success as a virtuoso thief. Wirth also seems to have fallen for the Duchess's bosomy charms. Eventually, he relinquished his Duchess to the greedy paws of robber baron J. Pierpont Morgan in a ploy every bit as clever as the original theft. McIntyre is not as smooth a writer as Wirth was a robber. Nevertheless, his biography of Wirth is packed with entertaining anecdotes about Wirth and his merry band of conspirators, rogues like Piano Charlie, a musical safecracker, and Marm Mandelbaum, a 300-pound woman who fenced millions of dollars of stolen goods. This is crime the way we'd like it to be, dripping with more charm than blood.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Music from the film The Grifters. Coming up, we meet Ken Finkelman, the man behind the CBC sitcom The Newsroom. This is Fresh Air. Canadian public television isn't exactly known for irreverent, razor-sharp, satiric comedies. But last season, it came out with The Newsroom, a parody of the behind-the-scenes antics of a Toronto CBC news show. The series was so cutting and cutting-edge, it immediately earned a cult following among newsrooms all over Canada and skyrocketed in the ratings. Even despite its very specific Canadian references, many PBS stations are picking up the series and will be airing it in September. The Newsroom will remind viewers in this country of the Larry Sanders Show in a newsroom setting. It depicts producers, reporters, and idiotic anchormen at their conniving, unctuous worst. Pettiest of them all is the news director, played by Ken Finkelman, who's also the creator, executive producer, and director of Newsroom. Finkelman is a veteran Hollywood writer. He has screenwriting credits on 16 movies, including the Madonna film Who's That Girl, and the sequels to Grease and to Airplane, which he also directed. Here's a scene from the show, The Newsroom. The news director, George, played by Ken Finkelman, is leading a typical morning story meeting.
The Toronto businessman vacationing in Florida. Remember the cops reported he was shot by two blacks? Well, they didn't do it. The wife confessed.
So it's a domestic thing.
He's still dead.
Yeah, well, so is the story. Canadian businessman, shot by his wife in Florida, doesn't work.
But shot by two black kids worked.
I didn't say that. The story doesn't work, okay? There's no hook.
By the way, the wife didn't actually pull the trigger. Allegedly, she put the boyfriend up to it.
Was the boyfriend black, at least?
He was white.
Pass on that.
Well, there is an amateur video of the body floating in the pool.
Was the body floating up, face up, or face down?
Face up.
Are the eyes open?
One eye was open. The other was gone.
Gone?
Shot out.
I love that. We got tape.
What about the welfare cuts?
Well, actually, the welfare cuts were bumped to second. We were going to do the horse and the hooker as a lead.
Well, I think we got two leads now. We got the body in the pool. We got the horse and the hooker and the developer.
Okay, well, who's for body in the pool?
I'm for body in the pool. Yeah.
Okay, hooker and horse? Body in the pool.
Body in the pool.
Okay.
Next.
Ken Fichtelman says the idea for the newsroom grew out of a lifetime of watching TV news. Obviously, he wasn't all that happy with what he saw.
I remember watching this one news story on CNN when they, you know, isn't it, give us 30 minutes, we'll give you the news, the world or something? But I remember seeing this story, this was just about a couple months ago. There was in the 30 minutes in which they're giving us the world news, there's a story of a guy who's like, he's in some kind of underground parking garage structure. You could sort of see it's all cement. And they have firemen there with hoses, and they've got him in a corner, and they've got the hoses, you know, sort of pushing him against the corner with the force of the water. And the story was that he was some kind of, you know, street, you know, person, some homeless sort of person that was crazy. And they restrained him. He must have been screaming or yelling or doing something that was antisocial. They restrained him with fire hoses in an underground garage. And they devoted about 3 minutes of the world news to this story. So that's what the news is. You know, if you have a woman, she's on fire, she's jumping from the 38th story of a building, they'll lead with that because they have the picture. Now, if they didn't have the picture and that story happened, you wouldn't know that woman existed, you know.
Now, there are two very funny and relentlessly weaselly producers on the show. They're played by comedians. They're not actors.
And
no. You've said somewhere that the only thing you demanded of these guys is that they don't try to crack jokes or try to be funny.
Yeah.
What did they take that to mean, that they not try to be funny?
Well, what you don't want to do is to start, you know, because they were stand-up comics, right? And you don't want them to do that in the midst of this type of show, because there's no sort of setups and punchlines in this show. But I like these guys because I find stand-up comics to be good playing themselves, because they just have a natural sense of timing, and they play themselves on the stage when they're, you know, to a certain extent. So they're not intimidated by the camera. So if you go and if you tell them don't act, they'll generally. If they are pretty good stand-up comics, some kind of entertaining persona will emerge. Do you know what I mean? Because they're most likely were class clowns, and they like the idea of having a camera on them, and I just sort of ask them to be themselves, and they generally did very well.
So it'll spark some snide, sarcastic comments, and retorts.
Well, they pretty well follow the script, but they bring sort of some kind of subtle air of comedy to the whole thing, because it's not really that funny a show. I'm not that good a comedy writer.
Well, you're not an actor by profession either.
No.
And when you portrayed your character, do you just slip into it in the same way? It brings out that same persona, that class clown in you?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wasn't certain. Well, I guess I sort of was the class clown, but a class clown. But I just sort of play the character because I find a lot of those impulses that he in myself.
Those impulses to obsess about your material.
Yeah,
possessions
obsess, and be obsessive, and be petty, and be self-absorbed, and all those things.
So you can kind of revel in it on stage.
Yeah, you can do that. And then in one of the episodes, which is about a nuclear meltdown at the end, the news director can't deal with it. He goes into denial, and he starts to sort of conjure up his past life and all these women that he's been had affairs with in his life, and I realized how much fun that is when you have that kind of control. Is that you can actually just sort of create an entire romantic world for yourself, write it, shoot it, and put yourself at the center of it as the actor, and sort of walk around in a nice suit and have these sort of attractive women kind of wanting answers from you. And you just write the real questions that you've always had in your life about these characters, and it's a tremendously exciting thing to do.
Kind of brings out the best and the worst in you.
Oh, yeah, terrible, terrible. Brings out the terrible part of it.
Now, your style as a director on the set, do you introduce ideas and let the actors run with them sometimes?
Not really, no. I ad-lib a lot because I don't remember. I have a lot of lines, and I don't remember any of the scripts when I'm about to shoot. I don't memorize the script at night or anything like that. I have no idea really what to say, what's in it, until I start to shoot it. And so I'll end up ad-libbing a lot, and people will be left kind of in the cold because they don't get cues and they don't know what to say and stuff. But after a number of takes, I'll generally have the script. And sometimes out of those messed up takes when I'm just sort of ad-libbing and we get sort of an exchange going, there's good stuff and we use it.
Writing for TV must be pretty frenetic, especially when you're the director and the producer and every other...
Well, no, it's actually not that... for me, I burnt out. I did 13 shows. I had nothing else to say. I wrote very, intuitively, and I didn't really follow any rules that because I'd written in Hollywood, and I know what notes are, and I know what structure is, and I know what the necessities of story and plot are, and I wasn't really terribly concerned with any of that stuff. So I was just felt that in satire, it's not really where with how the story ends, but how you get there. And then I would just sort of look at my computer and say, when I'm on page 29 or something, I would say, oh, I should stop it now. And I would write two more pages and finish everything off. So it was all very, it was all actually very undisciplined.
You did research by hanging out in a CBC newsroom in Toronto, right?
Yeah.
What were you looking for?
I was looking to see how the people dressed, and they dressed terribly here. So wardrobe had a very easy go of it, They're amazingly sort of unstylish, unfashionable, dowdy place. But none of them have ever shopped at Maxfield's in Los Angeles.
Were you interested in the rhythm of the workday? What people talked
about?
Yeah,
I was interested in that. I was interested in how the story meetings happen. They always start the morning off with the story meetings. And different producers pitch their ideas. And actually, reporters also pitch their ideas in the story meetings. And I tried to imagine myself at the center of it and how my personal life would sort of mix with that. And that's how the idea came. I also looked at the newsroom and how it was laid out. And when I went to the art director, I said, don't build sets, with the walls that can swing out so cameras can get in and stuff like that. Just build, actually bring the construction people in and build the actual room, the newsroom. So we actually built a room.
And it's pretty claustrophobic, too.
After a while, it was.
You had a CBC radio series earlier in your career with Rick Moranis, and it was called The Wednesday Report. What was the premise of the show?
Well, that was all. I've always done basically, the same thing. I'm kind of one-note person, that was also a satire of a CBC current affairs radio show. So that didn't have a laugh track, didn't have an audience, didn't have jokes, but it was a little sort of documentary. It was like a documentary, show, and we did sort of fake documentaries.
Have you ever performed before an audience?
I had a long time ago with Rick Moranis performed which the closest thing I can describe it to would be to those Bob and Ray kind of interviews. Those characters they used to those interviews, Bob and Ray, and we did these on a late night CBC talk show. And I was terrible, and I was petrified. And one night we used to do these live to tape, just to a tape with no audience. One night we had to do it in front of an audience, and I was on, and Tom Waits was on this show, and Rick and I had to do this thing, and I was so paralyzed with fear I couldn't speak. And so he said, "Well, why don't you just go across the street and get some beer?" And I went across the street and I got six beer, and I got drunk. I got so absolutely drunk I could hardly stand up. But I had no fear. I also had no talent.
And how did the act go?
It was terrible. It was absolutely frightening. It was just horrible.
Ken Finkelman is the creator, writer, producer, director, and star of the CBC sitcom The Newsroom. It's being picked up by PBS stations around the country.
You could be a thinking journalist. You know, remember Charles Corral, On the Road, Charles Corral?
Yeah, no, I used to watch him all the time. He did very smart.
Exactly, and this is your chance to do just as smart.
Absolutely. Okay, look, 53% of this province love Mike Harris, right? This is your audience. They love you. These are people who have values that you relate to, right? Golfing, hunting, fishing, family, hard work, church.
Alcohol.
Alcohol. You know, these guys get out there. They have a couple of drinks. They kill a couple of animals. They blow off some steam. The odd guy comes back and slaps his wife around.
But they're my audience.
People are sick of hearing about condoms and lesbians.
Yeah. No, I think this is great.
You know, anyway, I love this. This gives you an opportunity to blend the best of public broadcasting, which is...
Ideas,
with the best of the private sector, which is...
Being a guy with a motor.
The private sector.
Yeah.
Being a guy with a big motor.
Yeah.
A big motor.
Yeah.
Coming up, Ed Ward reviews the new Jimi Hendrix album. This is Fresh Air. Jimi Hendrix's last studio recordings were released piecemeal on a series of albums after his death, albums which had doctored tracks and other questionable material on them. After protracted legal action, the Hendrix family has gotten control over all of the existing recordings. So now we get to hear the album Jimi Hendrix left incomplete at his death.
There's a new Jimi Hendrix album out, which, considering that he's been dead for over 25 years, is certainly news. It bears the title of the one he was working on when he died, First Rays of the New Rising Sun. But the big question is if it's really that album at all. There's no way to find out, of course, but having listened to it, I'm willing to say it is. Since it's part of a 5-album release from Experience Hendrix, the company that the Hendrix family has formed to produce Jimmy's legacy, a legacy that's been shoddily treated in the years since his death, it carries with it a certain cachet, after all. The other 4 albums are the ones issued during Hendrix's lifetime. Are You Experienced?, Axis Bold as Love, Electric Ladyland, and Band of Gypsies. Newly remastered from the original tapes, they're a feast for Hendrix lovers, and for fans of experienced drummer Mitch Mitchell, the only rock drummer to have approached the heights of his jazz contemporaries Elvin Jones and Ed Blackwell.
Drifting on a sea of forgotten teardrops, on a lifeboat sailing for your love.
There's no question that the finished record would have sounded different, of course. Hendrix had become a studio obsessive, constantly mixing and remixing his tapes, and several of the tracks here were incomplete at his death in September 1970.
I used to live in a room full of mirrors. All I could see was me. I take my spirit and I smash my mirrors. Now the whole world is here for me to see. I said the whole world is here for me to see. Now I'm searching for my love to be. Hey!
Room Full of Mirrors, for instance, is a rough mix of a song he'd been working on for over 2 years. It sounds fine to us, of course, but did it to Hendrix? What comes across in this reconstruction is what we've known all along. Things were changing. Noel Redding, the Experience's bassist, was gone, replaced by Hendrix's army buddy, Billy Cox, who had deeper roots in traditional black music. On some tracks, Buddy Miles drums instead of Mitch Mitchell, although his approach is more mainstream rock than Mitchell's was. And although Hendrix was telling interviewers that the new album would have answers to the questions the protesters were asking, mostly what comes through is a sense of Hendrix having fun.
A little boy inside a dream just the other day. His mind fell out of his face and the wind blew it away. Came out from heaven to bend a badge on his chest. Just say, get out there, man, and do your best. Ooh.
This might have been because he was trying to put together a new band and spent a lot of time in his upstate New York house jamming with All and Sundry, a jam he brought to the stage with mixed results at Woodstock. Interestingly, the jam tune he used most often, called Beginnings here, was finally recorded using Mitchell and Cox. First Raise has both sides of what was to be the next Hendrix single, Dolly Dagger and Stepping Stone, which had been released but was withdrawn so Hendrix could replace Buddy Miles on the track with Mitchell.
Ooh, wait! Show
got the blues this morning, baby. Yeah, and I'm here to tell you about it. Might as well pick up on it. Yeah. I'm a man, at least I'm trying to be. But I've lived before the other half of me. I've lived before that true love to me. But I ain't gonna search for nothing desperately. Well, I'm trying, trying not to be a fool. Well, I'm trying, trying not to keep my cool, baby. Try so hard to keep it together. After I find, baby, that true love of mine, I'm just rolling, screaming, crying. Flying, can't be trusted, but busted, rolling stone.
It's also got a couple of tracks played at the opening of his new studio, Electric Lady, in New York. But the whole thing weighs in at 69 minutes, clearly too much for a 1970 LP, so we're left to wonder what would have been discarded. Thanks to CD technology, nothing has, so even 27 years later, its release is still an exciting event.
Ed Ward is a music writer living in Berlin. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, Dan Laughlin, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our interns are Francis Yu and Deborah Witkus. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Angel came down from heaven. Yesterday, she stayed with me just long enough to rescue me. And she told me a story yesterday about the sweet love between the moon and the deep blue sea. And then she spread her wings high over me. She said she's gonna come back tomorrow.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.